Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, have you ever raised sea monkeys?
I have.
Yeah. Were you disappointed?
Yeah, a little bit, but I think I was more intrigued by the atmosphere that they were living in. That seemed really magical.
Well, on the package, it looks magical.
Right.
Because it shows these little creatures living, and they have like a little undersea kingdom.
Right.
And then you expect that to take place.
To pop up.
And it doesn't really happen.
No, it doesn't. But I was taken with that. I thought, oh yes, finally.
Well, like growing sprouts is, I find that to be far more satisfying. And at the end, I have like something delicious to put on a sandwich. Sea monkeys, not that delicious.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
They're a species of brine shrimp, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not to take away the mystique here, but.
Yeah. They're not actually, hominids in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. Tiny sea monkeys.
Yeah.
But, according to their packaging, they are a true miracle of nature.
Are they?
Yes.
Well, I mean, everything is really, but. But you know, there's these undersea kingdoms that they had. It really captured my imagination. I think a lot of people's imaginations because there's something in the psyche that just wants to see underwater cities. I guess it's just the impossible nature of it, the sort of topsy turvy world aspect of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about it geographically, it is like the earth turned upside down, or not the earth, but the what we see here, us landlubbers. So why wouldn't you want to hang out in that submerged mountain range?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's the mystery of it too, like the what's underneath the water, you know? You can see some fish, something that looks kind of like a mermaid.
Yeah, and then there's the whole tranquil thing.
Yeah, and you know, it's like you're weightless, and it's an idea that's been explored a number of times. Like just to run through like a few of the famous ones. Like in myth, you have the lost cities of Es and Atlantis.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, you do.
Oh, I thought you were correcting me because I wasn't exactly sure how to pronounce because it looks kind of like Yes and it's I thought it was pronounced like Es, but it could be Yes, city of Yes.
Yes. No, I was just agreeing. They are mythic.
You have the city of Rapture in the BioShock games. You have. Lioness in War Gods of the Deep. You have the lost city of Atlanta in Futurama. Did you ever see that one?
No.
It's like the city of Atlanta, where we're podcasting from, is completely submerged and mer people live in it.
Oh my goodness. You know? I'm going to have to seek that one out.
And it's not, I mean, it's like an outsider's critique.
Okay,
like,
I was going to say, does it have MARTA? Does it have poor underground Atlanta? Or
yeah, because an insider's view of the lost city of Atlantis, I think, would be a lot more interesting, at least to Atlanta.
Yeah.
Because what happens to MARTA when it's submerged?
It's still late.
Yeah. You have, of course, Sub Diego of Aquaman. You have the city of, and I'm never sure how to pronounce this, even though I've read Lovecraft numerous times, but you have the city of Relay.
Yeah, I know. I've always wondered how to do that. Yeah.
I always just think of it as like Cthulhu Town, you know. Or
yeah, right. That's where Cthulhu lives.
Yeah. And then you have like various like mechanical underwater cities that have popped up, like not always cities, but sometimes just habitats. Anyone who's seen any of the like the late 90s, I feel like it was when we had just tons of underwater base, underwater city situations showing up in films. You had like The Abyss, you had Deep Star 6, you had Leviathan, Lords of the Deep.
Right. It was Waterworld.
Waterworld. Did they ever go underwater? I've never seen Waterworld.
I haven't either. Actually, I think that they, not having seen it though, I think that they just created like a bunch of floating areas, floating cities.
So.
Nonetheless.
Yeah.
They were on the water.
Well, they were on the water. They might have had stuff on, slightly on
the water. I bet they took a swim every once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. In the unfilmed sequel, maybe. But anyway, outside of the realm of myth and fantasy and science fiction, we've actually looked into this through a number of experiments, and it's an idea that continues to capture the imagination, and it often ends up spilling over into scientific inquiry.
Yeah, and it seems to me like the 1950s saw a really big fascination with this, and that this has some parallels with space colonization.
Yeah.
The same sort of idea where we could enter this mysterious, quiescent space and live our lives in a completely different way.
Yeah. And it goes back, like anytime you look at like the Walt Disney, Epcot Center visions of tomorrow or, you know, the world of tomorrow. And it was, you know, it was always like, oh, we're going to do it, guys. We're going to have cities on the moon. We're going to live underwater in cities. It was just this, since that same sense of optimism that you know that told us that with science at our side, you know, the stars are ours, and it's, you know, so of course the ocean is also within our grasp.
Of course, the funny thing now is it's driven by pessimism, I think, because it's like, well, we're really eating up all the natural resources here and taking up a lot of land. Maybe we should explore the oceans a little bit more. Maybe it's possible to live underneath them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's like, oh, well, the environment's not going too hot. Everything's going to be underwater anyway.
Right, right.
So can we make everything float or make it just all, you know, waterproof?
Yeah. So 2050 New York City, maybe it's just a chain of little islands and underground pods. Who knows?
So one of the first that really comes to mind, and this is when people were actually like, let's do it. Let's try it out. Because, on the surface of things, like the idea sounds pretty simple. You know, if you're not familiar with any of the science involved, it's like, well, let's just build something underwater. You know, it's airtight. Pump some air down to it, and people will live in it. That'd
right.
be great.
Right. It'll be like the channel.
Yeah, but it gets a lot more complicated than that. And one of the main guys who was really looking into this in the late 50s, early 60s was, of course, Jacques Cousteau.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought you were.
I said yes.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to do more of a French take on Cousteau because I feel like I'm not getting the proper.
Clé.
Oh, okay. This just one syllable? Is that?
Eh?
Okay.
I don't know.
Anyway.
It's not my forte.
Jacques Cousteau's, that's right. You're more Italian.
Si.
Okay. But Jacques Cousteau had the Conshelf project. And this was a series of three underwater habitats that they explored. And it gets right into the idea of the aquanaut, which is like the astronaut except underwater, basically.
Right.
It's just going down for an extended period of time, you know, adapting to the pressure, scuba divers living and operating both inside and outside or an underwater shelter.
Right. And to be, you know, specific about it, and we're not talking about David Blaine like doing some sort of like 17-minute stunt under the water.
Right.
But it's more about someone living in a underwater habitat or using some sort of device for 24 hours or more in
right.
order to explore the area around him or herself.
Yeah. No, the first one of these that Jacques Cousteau and company pulled off was Conchel 1, and this is 1962, and this is just off the coast of France near Marcellus.
Okay.
And they just went down about 33 feet, 10 meters, and this thing just looked like a big steel yellow barrel, about 16 feet, 5 meters long, 8 feet, 2.5 meters in diameter. And it was a home laboratory, two guys in there, 1 week, 30 people observing from the surface, monitoring these guys' health.
Right.
And they'd leave the tube for 5-hour shifts to study sea life, work on an underwater farm, which sounds fabulous. And, again, they're just like, they weren't actually like, all right, we got to get a crop going this week. It's more like,
right.
let's observe. What would happen if we actually did have people down on the bottom of the ocean working on something? Let's look at their vitals. Let's see how they're doing.
Right. And it's a really practical solution too, right? Because they don't have to decompress. They don't mm-hmm. have to worry about coming up. So if they're able to hang out there for a while, then they can, amass a lot of data, look
yeah.
at it, continue to go out, so on and so forth.
Yeah, because just without getting to a whole lot of depth about the bins, but you go down to certain depths, you have more pressure, and that causes the gas in breathable air to dissolve into your flesh.
Right, nitrogen.
Yeah, and if you surface too fast, you get nitrogen bubbles, which can be exceedingly painful or fatal. So, which means the longer you stay down, the longer you need to come back up.
Yep. Right. And it was originally called the Grecian Bend, by the way.
The Grecian Bend.
Yeah. Huh. I don't know what. Maybe they attributed bending to the Grecians. I don't know. But
huh.
They observed people bending over.
Oh, wow. So it's actually like you would come up and you
mm-hmm.
would just be bent over. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Doubled
I
over. As
did
it were.
Not know that.
Yeah.
So Conchel 1 was a success. It's just sort of like, let's test it out. Let's see. Because this hadn't really been done before. You had guys going down in submarines. Sure. You had... people have been diving underwater to catch fish, and Jacques Cousteau certainly spent a lot of time developing scuba aqualung technology, but this was a real first.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty groundbreaking, and even though it was basically like a low tech it was like a shipping container basically.
Yeah.
It's low tech in terms of what we think of today, but
yeah, and you look at images from the inside and it looks like two dudes living in a big barrel. Like it looks rugged. It's not
socks everywhere. It's not pretty.
Yeah, it's not very Steve Zissou. It's just like guys living in a barrel. So this was a success. So they're like, let's try something a little more ambitious. Let's actually maybe leave, our French backyard here and prove that we can do this in a more exotic location. So they went to, the Red Sea and then went down, this time again, 10 meters, in depth, 33 feet. And, Conchel 2 had like three different facilities, basically two
yeah.
main facilities. There was a starfish house, which doesn't look as much like a starfish.
No, it doesn't.
But it had like a central hub and like these little areas come sticking off from the side.
Mm-hmm.
When we do a blog post for a roundup for these podcasts, for this week's podcast, I'll be sure to, throw a link to a couple of good sites that have lots of cool images of these. The main starfish house contained crew quarters, bathroom facilities, a dining area, a laboratory. So suddenly everything is a lot more life aquatic.
Right.
A lot more, like we think of as an undersea base and less like a barrel.
Right. They're thinking more aesthetically now.
Yeah. And next door to this, they have a structure that they call the aquarium, which was basically a garage, for the diving saucer vehicle that they had, which, cool little submersible unit. For zooming around underwater, an equipment hangar. And then they also had a complex called Deep Station, which was located, 82 feet, deep. So it was, it was even deeper than the main station.
Right.
And this was a habitat filled with oxygen, helium mixture, with the inhabitants, divers leaving the habitat to do daily work below 160 feet.
Okay. Is this the one that they spent a month in?
Yes, yeah, five aquanauts or oceanauts, would live.
If you're French.
Yeah.
No, I really think that, they call them oceanauts.
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 Yeah. five of these guys would, or gals, I think they were all guys in this though, would live for a month in the Starfish base. Two of them would spend a week in the deep station.
Mm-hmm.
And, once more, project was successful, and Cousteau began talking about a third project.
Yeah, and again, I see the parallels here between this and space, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's, you're completely isolated, you're with very few people. I mean, even though they've gotten a little bit more pimped out here,
mm-hmm.
It's still aesthetically, like, not like it is at home. The comfort level isn't as great. And you have to wonder about the psychological ramifications of this, too.
Yeah, just basically, I mean, it's like you get down to the basics of humans need sunlight. And the deeper you go, the less sunlight there is. It's
right.
Just a weird habitat.
Plus being, like, soggy all the time, that's got to chafe.
Yeah, to say nothing of the athlete's foot down there. or maybe it was called conchelf foot.
With those in the know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, we talked about the space exploration. A lot of the data that came out of this and other experiments in the early 60s. I mean, it was stuff that they were able to apply to contemplating, you know, habitats in orbit.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So 1965 now we're up to, and this is Conchelf 3, the third and final underwater habitat. And this was like the ultimate. This was like a large yellow and black six-person sphere, which was lowered to a depth of 328 feet, 100 meters. So the crew lived on Conchelf 3 for 3 weeks, venturing out each day to work in a mock-up oil well. And, just to test their ability to leave this thing and work and then come back. And again, it was a success. They were able to show that yes, we can put people down there at a considerable depth,
yeah.
And they can actually operate and work within this this time limit. So
right, and actually, 300 feet is the norm, right, for what we usually go down to in terms of depth that we have access to.
Yeah,
yeah, because otherwise, then you get down into the really cold, extremophile territory, so to speak.
Yeah, so this was really pushing the envelope. At the same time, the U.S. Navy was interested in this, too. And so they had the C-Lab programs, which this is one of the reasons I did not mention C-Lab 2021 earlier, because I didn't want to confuse the issue. But this is the actual C-Lab,
mm-hmm.
Not to be confused with any cartoon.
Right.
So 64, C-Lab 1, and this was various, like the C-Lab, like Conchelf, rolled out in three phases, very similar. C-Lab 1 was a, windowless red cylinder, had four guys in it, 11 days, performing physical, biological experiments. They were doing stuff with, ultrasonic beacons and anti-shark cages, again, just to see how they, performed. And this was off Panama City, Florida. And then they moved it about 26 miles southwest of Bermuda and tried it out at 200 feet. And it was a success, so they did C-Lab 2 in 65. And this was out in San Francisco. And they had 10 men, depth of 200 feet, 30 days. It was another cylinder-type situation. So it wasn't as cool. It's just me, but it's not as cool looking as Conchelf 2. But C-Lab 2 was bigger, looked kind of like a little submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And they conducted, physiological, psychological studies.
Yeah, that's what I think is interesting about this part is they took a lot of what they learned from Conchelf, right?
Yeah.
Because Conchelf originally, I think, was pitched to them, and they said no in Costa.
They decided to do their own thing.
Yeah, and Jacques Cousteau said, "Oh, I'll take it on." So it's what I think is interesting about C-Lab is that they really are looking at this like the psychological strains and the physiological strains on the person as well.
Yeah. And the number of experiments that they did on C-Lab 2 was actually pretty cool. Like they just really threw a lot of tasks at these guys.
Yeah.
Like they were evaluating the structural engineering of the habitat. They worked on the mock-up for a submarine hull. They tested undersea tools. They used like foam to raise an old Navy jet fighter to the surface. They experimented with plants, and they also experimented with a trained porpoise named Tuffy to do, quote, courier work between the habitat and the surface.
Tuffy.
Tuffy. And Tuffy was trained to respond to a buzzer. And Tuffy would apparently did a pretty good job of bringing them mail, tools, and bottles of soda, which, I don't know, it sounds kind of demeaning, but...
No, but, I mean, there's part of that. Part of that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, who hasn't trained their dog to probably get them a beer? Well, not me, because I don't have a dog, but it's always seemed like a good thing to do.
Yeah, has the cat been able to succeed in that yet?
No.
Oh, okay. No. Well, keep working.
No, I mean, he's working on bigger projects.
Okay.
Yeah, that he can't discuss with me.
Well, sadly, C-Lab 3, which was similar to C-Lab 2, just kind of like more robust, it ended up being kind of a disaster, unfortunately. And this was February 1969. They lowered it down to the ocean floor off the coast of California. They sent four divers down to repair a helium leak on C-Lab 3. And during the attempt, one of the divers died, apparently, of carbon dioxide asphyxiation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were concerned about their safety, and they just shut it down.
I mean, this is the rub, right? The CO2 problem.
Yeah.
I mean, this is obviously why we can't colonize the oceans. Lucky for the oceans, I suppose. But that doesn't mean that we don't continue to try and build really, like, macked out stuff like the Trilobus 65.
Oh, yeah. This one's really... really awesome looking. This particular submersible habitat was the cover story for Popular Mechanics back in 2002. So you may have seen it there. I'll just throw a link up to the website. It has the images of it.
It's so cool.
Yeah, it's really, really, I dare say, boss.
Yes.
You know, it looks like a James Bond villain should be living in it and feeding people to sharks.
It's true. It's like a sphere, right?
Yeah.
It's got four kind of separate levels.
Yeah.
Yep. It's very like retro to me at the same time.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a space clam that lives in the water.
Yeah.
It's really cool. But
the clam part being like the where the windows are and
And it has like lots of areas, you know, set by the window and observe you know, fish and dolphins swimming by, all that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's definitely for the gadfly of the seas, right?
Yeah.
And it's got a spiral staircase connecting all four levels.
Yeah. So it's neat. We'll see if it ever actually gets built. But the design's out there.
Yeah. What I like about it, too, is that they say that the shape allows for modular aggregation, creating colonies, if you'd like.
Oh.
So, I mean, to me, I think of it as like this super futuristic Sausalito. You know, these sort of, they're not houseboats, but... necessarily, but these communities of,
so they kind of like hook up and
right, you can have like a whole community of trilobus if you'd like. Trilobi.
There of course is we discussed this a little bit in Life on the 500th Floor, but you have Hydropolis, which is the planned underwater skyscraper in Dubai, right?
Yeah, and it's at this time right now, it's, I think it's still in the works, AKA being crushed by the economy.
Yeah.
So I don't know where they are in the process, but it does sound like this completely crazy superfly. Of course, it's in Dubai, right? So it's not going to be a junky structure. But it includes a shopping mall, restaurants, movie theater, and my favorite, the missile defense system, all 60 feet underwater.
Yeah. But you know, the economy's been rough on everybody. So in Dubai, they've just said to be like, all right, we're going to tighten the belt. We're just going to build the largest skyscrapers that have ever, you know, been erected on the planet, and we'll just hold off on building underwater skyscrapers that are protected by atomic weapons.
Right, exactly. But what I like about this is that it, you know, a poor man's Hydropolis is the Jules Undersea Lodge, which is named after the author of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Jules Verne. And that is actually the world's first underwater hotel. And it was originally built in the 70s as a research lab off the coast of Puerto Rico. And then it was relocated to Key Largo in 86 and opened its hatch to the public then. But it's 21 feet under the sea and you have to scuba dive to get to it.
Oh, wow.
So unlike Hydropolis, which they plan to have like this crazy clear glass tube that shoots you underneath.
Oh wow! It's like
to the lobby.
It's like in Futurama where they have these tubes, that shoot people, like pneumatic tubes. That
And supposedly it is supposed to be in the shape of a jellyfish or resemble a jellyfish.
All right.
I don't know really how that works, but that seems like more like a subway system to me.
Yeah, maybe they can work on making the overall design even more ambitious.
Right, right. Or they could, you know, save some money and streamline it.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are different ways that you can get at living undersea if you'd like, you know, if you are the gadfly about town.
One of the interesting things we were looking at the other day, too, is that you have the National Science Foundation's Ocean Observations Initiative.
And
this is it kind of forces you. It's a complex, multi-scale observatory plan where you have it's like, you know, everything from like just very regional observations of the undersea environment to kind of interconnect into like a global. It's kind of like putting spy cameras on, like the very rough explanation is like, let's put spy cameras and sensors automated on the ocean floor. Let's have, you know, automated submersibles sort of going on patrol and checking out conditions.
Like, let's collect data on every single thing we could collect data on. And, you know, let's run fiber optic lines all over the place. Like you said, cameras. Let's have platforms that we can observe, submersibles, anything and everything. Because the idea is that the entire world can benefit from better knowing its oceans and that we can help to predict climate change. We can look at the population of species and really better understand what's going on. Because right now, I mean, the ocean is largely unknown to us, again, parallel to space. And, you know, it's covering more than 70% of the world. So it does kind of make you say, oh, okay, that seems like it might be a good idea.
Yeah, and it's an interesting parallel to space, too, because, like, both visions of us, you know, moving under the ocean and moving into the cosmos, like, it was very much tied with the scientific exploration. We're going to go down there and figure out how things work. We're going to go up there and figure out what space is all about. And eventually the technology reaches the point where we're like, well, we can actually do that easier without, you know, trying to tackle all these problems involving how do you take a fragile human being that's designed to live in a certain layer of the Earth's atmosphere. How are you going to, you know, create the technology to safely send that into orbit or into, you know, pressurized depths when we can just send robots instead? And you know, and the idea is understanding what's going on down there. So, you know, we can. Well, this is a classic example. I mean, it's a lot like robotic probes. You know, it's we can do this without necessarily sending people down there.
Right. And the oceanographer John Delaney, who's heading up the team working on this, he was actually saying, I mean, he wasn't saying this was the Holy Grail, but I was thinking about it as the Holy Grail in the sense that it's a quest to better understand our world, but not only that. That beneath the ocean floor, there's all this biomass tied up living in microbes. They're living in the sea cracks or beneath the floor. And the total amount of biomass living at the surface of the ocean floor actually exceeds that of the planet's surface.
Wow.
So his idea is, could it be the next rainforest in terms of potential pharmaceuticals?
Right.
And that's the Holy Grail element that I think that is really enticing, but also, you know, could be a red herring.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it would be really interesting to find out what sort of bacteria is there and could it be useful to us. Now, the flip side of that is, okay, when you start to interrupt ecosystems, because presumably there would be some level of interruption when you're laying on the cable, which we've done a lot anyway, and you have all these submersibles, you know, what is it doing to the oceans?
Yeah. Because, I mean, on one level, it's like we're already we've been putting a lot of crap down there for ages and, you know, we're erecting, you know, oil rigs and everything else. But, you know, this would be for a much more positive, purpose. But still, you're laying a lot of cable. You're putting a lot of machines out there. Stuff's gonna, you know, there's gonna be a certain amount of, litter that's gonna.
Yeah. And if you're gonna try to map the entire ocean with sonar, what is that gonna do to the, you know, population of, you know, dolphins?
We already have examples of a certain like Navy sonar, techniques that are interfering with certain types of whales and dolphins. So,
And the breeding and they're getting, I guess it's sort of confusing them in terms of what they're perceiving, from the sonar. So there's that question. I mean, it really is intriguing to be able to find out more. And what if there is a sort of rainforest at the bottom of the sea for us?
What if there's a mermaid kingdom and we, or we've discovered the lost city of Atlantis and we tick them off with our robots and they attack us.
It could happen.
Yeah.
Well, if you're like Richard Branson, you just get into your submersible and you zoom away. And I'm not kidding.
I keep forgetting that he has a submersible. I end up reading far more about his interest in space and.
Right. Yeah. Again, here we go. He can't help himself either. Space and in the ocean. It's called the Necker Nymph. I know. The name, I'm sorry. But the Necker part is Necker Island, which he owns, you know, his private island. And the Nymph part, I suppose, is supposed to be a sea nymph. But it can dive to depths of up to 130 feet, and he hopes to one day explore depths of 35,000 feet plus. But it can carry a pilot and two visitors. It can go on a 2-hour trip. And, after you have to, of course, be, fluid in the language of scuba diving in order to do this, mm-hmm. I guess as a legal, protocol or something. But, the Nymph is available for hire. It's $25,000 a week.
It just sounds like like some sort of a pleasure barge. It just,
the Nymph.
Yeah.
I know. Richard Branson. Come on. I mean, that's, what do you expect? But just in case you're wondering, it does have fighter jet technology.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah. Because, you know, just in case you do come across Atlantis. So, I mean, I don't know. All this sort of bears out the question of what are we doing to the oceans? Who even owns the oceans?
Yep. Josh Clark has an awesome article on that.
He does.
You can do a search on the How Stuff Works homepage and find that.
Yeah. And will we ever permanently have human occupation of the seafloor? I don't think so, but it could happen.
We'll see. We'll see. Well, I mean, we won't see. We'll be dead, but somebody will see.
Oh, I'm laughing about that. Dead. Yay.
Well, hey, we have some listener mail here. And the first one actually corresponds with the theme of this podcast. We recently did an episode on accessorizing. To make us more than human.
That's right.
And one of the technologies that we covered was the dolphin suit, which you wore for that podcast.
Yeah, kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a hit at the Y.
Yeah, I bet. So Richard, a listener by the name of Richard sends this in. He says, "Hi, I recently bought these," and he throws a link to something called the Dark Fin Gloves. I thought it was Dark Fin Gloves, but it's Dark Fin Gloves. .com. Not sure if I will ever use them, but I thought they were really cool and priced well enough that I should own them just to say I own them. Maybe I'll freak my daughter out at bath time or something. So if you go to the website, and did you have a chance to look at these?
No, I haven't.
All right. Well, they're black webbed gloves, and they kind of look like Creature from the Black Lagoon hands. Mm-hmm. And I think would make an interesting companion to those toe shoes that people wear.
Oh, right. Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that, actually.
I've heard mixed things. But
well, I mean, I think toes are a separate issue unto themselves. I'm not quite sure that you should define them with toe sock shoes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's for another podcast, I suppose.
But no, these look pretty cool. I mean, they look kind of creepy and would be ideal for creeping somebody out at bath time. but also, I mean, it's like, it's just adding webbing to improve, your speed.
Right.
And I wonder too, if like, I try and swim semi-regularly, and I find that like holding my hand together to make a scoop to swim with, I end up, my fingers feel kind of sore the next day.
Well, that makes sense, because you're flexing your muscles and your hands and your fingers.
Yeah, but it freaks me out.
Because you don't normally go around like that all day long, right?
Well, yeah, just in case I need to karate chop somebody. You know?
Right.
So I'm just constantly, and then I have to type. So, but
yeah, it's dangerous in these halls. You never know.
You never know.
Yeah.
But it makes me wonder. It's like, should I look into having something that like holds my fingers together so I'm not straining to create that scoop? I don't know.
I think so.
Yeah. I should probably do a search on it.
I mean, keep in mind you have to type. You don't want to, you know.
Yeah, these are the money makers.
Exactly.
I can't depend just on podcasting.
That's right. Those babies are insured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Richard, thanks for sending that in. They are pretty cool. And that's, again, that's darkfingloves.com. They have cool pictures. You can check them out. We also received an email from a listener by the name of Derek. And he responded to our, in a recent podcast, I mentioned how Atlanta shows up in The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And it has all these like post-apocalyptic looking locations, despite the fact that the film doesn't take that far in the future, so it's like Atlanta's pretty post-apocalyptic looking already if you look in most of the right places. Anyway, he just wrote in to say to point out that it says, quote, "While hopefully Atlanta doesn't look quite as post-apocalyptic as it does in The Walking Dead," it does, "that's not the reason it was chosen for the filming. The actual reason for it is that the series is based on a long-running comic series by Robert Kirkman. And in the comics, that was one of the major cities that was thrown out there to the living as a stronghold before it fell to the zombies."
Ah.
So he just was clearing that up. And he also said, apart from that, this was really interesting. He's talking about the life on the 500th floor episode. Mm-hmm. The concepts of virtual farming are mind-blowing, though I think I'll be sad if I live to see the day when people live their entire lives in the same building. The loss of cross-culture and social creation would be a very interesting thing to study, though. Isolated pockets of individuals whose influence is based off of what would essentially be isolationism and a futuristic internet social network. The psychological and sociological discussion would be endless.
Yeah, seriously. And I mean, that begs the question about whether or not we'd have tribes within these buildings, these vertical living platforms. We'd all have a different tribe and different buildings. It would be
Different cultures in each building, like warring with each other.
Well, and gene pools too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd basically have different, maybe you'd reach the point where like you have building A, building B, and like they can't even like breed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and instead of identifying yourself as an American or Australian, mm-hmm. you say, "I'm building A."
Yeah. Now, tell me, wait, Romeo and Juliet, wasn't part of the thing that everybody lived in like sort of ancient skyscrapers to a certain extent? Like am I remembering that correctly? They lived in that region had sort of tall buildings, and each family would have like a building.
I don't recall. There's definitely a balcony in that. So
yeah, maybe so.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, futuristic Romeo and Juliet, one species living in building A, one species living in building B.
Who's going to write it?
I don't know. I'm throwing it out. Maybe me.
Yeah.
Maybe you, the listener. Send it in when you get it done. next 3 weeks would be good.
Yeah.
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 And if you want to send us anything else, you can certainly come to visit our Facebook or Twitter pages. We are Blow the Mind on both of those, and we are constantly updating that with links to cool How Stuff Works articles, cool articles from elsewhere on the web, and our own blog posts.
That's right. And if you'd like to send us an email, please do so at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com. Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.